Hello. Gosh. Thank you. There's a lot of clapping.
That was a smooth start.
That was good. Hello, happy Vonk Week, everybody. I'm Dorian Linsky. Let's meet the people who'll be going up against our zombie PM. Roz Taylor is a newly minted freelancer in the process of writing a new book. Pandering. There's been exciting contests between Johnson loyalists, see who can produce the most embarrassing spin. All hail the latest victory of our glorious leader, Comrade Big Dog, over his treacherous enemies. Who was your favourite?
There were so many, weren't there? There were just so many. It was extraordinary. I think my favourite was Bob Seeley, who is MP for Isle of Wight. And he basically issued a statement in which he said, I'm supporting the Prime Minister because the Prime Minister has promised the Isle of Wight local council some extra money. And I'm prepared to wait around and see if the Prime Minister delivers on that promise. And that's why I'm voting for the Prime Minister. And the sheer kind of pork shamelessness about the pork barrel politics of that was what really cut through for me.
I enjoyed Nadine Doris saying that we were at war with Ukraine. So Foreign Secretary in the next reshuffle, I imagine. Ian Dunt is a columnist of The Eye and co-presenter of Origin Story, the hit new podcast whose other presenter is pretty good, I'm told.
Would you like to talk about the other presenter more, his various skills?
I'm going to spare his blushes. I spent some of the Jubilee holiday in this very weird village, actually a very normal village in Suffolk, for people who live in Suffolk, it's probably very normal. But it had so many flags that it was like the village in The Prisoner. And like number six was going to be told to put up more bunting because he was being unmutual. And I thought, oh, right, this is actually Jubilee land. This is problem. And I came back to London and people were just like, eh. Not on the Mull. I didn't come back to the Mull, obviously. They're quite into it there. How was your, how did you celebrate her, Madge?
Well, it was dreadful, obviously. And I celebrated it the way I celebrate everything, which is just staying at home and closing the windows. And you have that sort of, so the weird experience that you get is you have the two worlds of media on a weekend like that. You have the media of what's going on the radio and the TV, and then you have the media of social media. Sort of on the radio and TV, they really heavily do the theatrics of royalty. So, you know, even fucking any normal sort of news bulletin, so like, Her Majesty's gracious feet touched upon the ground. If only one could reach one's tongue as close to the heel of the foot, you know, it just goes to this whole other fucking weird place.
There's Duke Alexander of Liechtenstein there, descending from the carriage.
Right, it's fucking horrific, and I can't take that. And then you go on social media, because of the kind of people I follow, it's all just like, these fuckers! Like, we will write the constitution in their blood, you know? And so you're just like, fucking Christ. So no, it was dreadful, it was
obviously
terrible.
There's the guillotine there being wheeled out. yeah, sounds good. Sounds like a good weekend. Here's commentator Alex Andreou. Hi, Alex.
Hello.
There's an exciting Twitter action today from pollster Chris Curtis.
Wasn't there, yeah.
Who revealed some things about government pressure on YouGov during the 2017 election. Chris was obviously quite taken aback by the reaction.
Yes. All hell broke loose, didn't it?
What was the meat of that thread?
The meat of that thread was that there were two or three instances where there were polls that were indicating during the 2017 sort of campaign period that Labour were closing the gap and that maybe it would be a hung parliament, and there was pressure from above to not go there, which then made them think twice, second-guessing themselves throughout that campaign period of, is this safe to put out? And it included an instance of Nadeem Zahawi, who co-founded YouGov, calling the CEO of the company and saying, if you get this wrong, I will ask for your resignation. Which Nadeem Zahawi then came out and said, it was a joke. It was a joke between... joke between old friends. He did point out that pound sterling had dropped 1.5 cents on news of that poll. That's how he opened. So maybe Eddie Izzard could make that work as a sort of meta joke, but I don't really see the humour in calling an old pal and saying, so you just destroyed the country's currency, and I will have your head on a plate.
I wouldn't open with it.
Psych.
But ironically, of course, one of the reasons Labour did so well, it was said, was that a lot of people didn't think Labour were going to do that well. You know, and that actually putting out that poll would actually more likely have helped the Conservatives.
Well, maybe. Maybe it got the vote out. So, you know, and if Conservative voters thought it was going to be closer, maybe more of their vote would have gone out. So, I mean, I don't know how these people think. But the problem with it is that it feeds that conspiracy that, oh, the polls are all... Yeah. I mean, like I say to everyone all the time, don't pay attention to individual polls. They can be problems with the methodology, they can be outliers, they can be a sample that's not quite right. But if you look at the aggregate movement, that's quite reliable in showing trends. You know, not getting the percentages right, but showing who's coming up and who's going down.
Any time polling is criticised, I know that someone's going to put around that Peter Hitchens... Is it Peter Hitchens meme?
Yeah.
And anything that triggers a Peter Hitchens meme is bad news. Yeah. especially Peter Hitchens. A special guest with his flag is Raphael Baer, Guardian leader writer and host of the Politics on the Couch podcast.
Hi, yeah, our flag.
You're really going to work this.
I am, yeah. This is a home fixture for me. You know?
Yeah, why not?
Although our home record was pretty poor this season, but I won't go there. That's okay.
Is he talking about football?
Oh, yeah, association football. Yeah.
I don't have any idea what the distinction is between that and the rest of it.
Well, I'm going to say don't put your hands on the ball, but that we'll come to that later.
Am I wearing the right colour? Because the flag is blue.
That's it. I wore special blue jeans. Raph, Tom Harwood, one of your chief rivals, broke the story yesterday of Sue Gray using...
You mean rival as a style icon, you mean, as opposed to...
As a heartthrob. Using a karaoke machine in Downing Street in pictures taken before the pandemic when this was absolutely fine. As a seasoned political journalist, does it hurt to be scooped?
It's agony, really. Do you know, it turns out I was aware that Chris Whitty once shared a bowl of nachos in 2015. And if I could have run that, I could have put that on
the
front page.
You got it, right?
No, I mean, the thing is, I mean, first of all, it's actually revealing in a couple of ways. I mean, I should say the reason I'm a columnist is because I was so terrible at getting scoops as a reporter in the first place. I sort of fled actual news gathering. And in theory, you kind of, earn your spurs as a reporter and then you get to be a commentator. But I was so terrible at spotting exclusives. I would see things on the front page, speculation about some minister's going to get sacked or someone's going to get promoted. And I'd see it as the splash on the front of the Times. I think, oh, yeah, I'd heard that as well. Oh, yeah, maybe that was news. But the interesting thing about this story about the karaoke gate, which is not being called, is, well, first of all, a couple of things. But the most revealing, two revealing ones for me are that clearly there was an operation to try and discredit Sue Gray at that moment. It was on the day of the vote no confidence, just to try and sort of muddy the waters, let off a stink bomb somewhere. So just the sheer nastiness of that, to go, we found this picture of this poor woman singing from a song from Greece. I mean, imagine this. There's probably audio somewhere, which there will be for the next time they have to try and...
Tell me more, Harwood. Tell me more.
You paid for this.
Yeah. Yeah, she did put up a fight. No, the other extraordinary thing about that is, first of all, there's this sort of horrible mafia operation to try and discredit her. But also, the fact that it ended up on Twitter being posted by this person, the GB News presenter, who no one's heard of apart from whether they waste too much time on Twitter or watch GB News, which someone must be doing, is that imagine that having like first, they presumably they first went to the Mail, right? And then, Mail, even the Mail didn't want it. And then they went to the Express, and even the Express were like, really? So imagine like being the person, like the meal, someone brings you this meal and it's all chewed up and go, well, the Mail spat it out and the Express dropped it on the floor. But look, if I put some ketchup on it, then you can eat it. And you're like, oh yeah, yum, yum, great. Fantastic, you know. It is a bit demeaning, isn't it? Let's be honest.
But his bio does say, I do real news. Which, is, of course, is what was on Woodward and Bernstein's business card. And that all professional journalists like to point out they do real news. Tonight on the show, Boris Johnson survives a vote of no confidence. Why, how, and what now? Plus, I'll be quizzing the panel on his greatest hits throughout the years. And in part two, in the wake of Platy Jubes, we talk national identity and whether the United Kingdom is due a vibe shift. So first up, after months of sweaty speculation on this very podcast, Graham Brady finally received enough letters to trigger a vote of no confidence. Johnson won, I mean, you do know this, but only by 60-40 split, with around three quarters of non-payroll MPs voting against. Technically, he's safe for another year, but is he really? I just want to ask everyone, like, what did you, was that higher than you expected, the 148?
Yeah, I had 138.
120.
Oh, shit, I didn't have a number. Were we supposed to come here with like a...
No, I just wonder if you
did. You either had one or you didn't.
I went...
Who even are you?
I was hoping it would so reach 100. That was my key thing.
I went for 144, but...
So specific.
But then Mystic Meg, what's his name? There's some political pundit who got 147.
He's definitely not called Meg if it's a he.
He's not called Meg.
No.
I know that.
John Tong. Hmm? John Tong.
Yeah, he got 147.
Yeah, his moment in the sun. It won't last.
But it was but it was high.
It was about as high as it could go. He actually got 147 because he thought the alleged rapist wouldn't vote. But actually, he did vote by proxy. So the only reason he was out by one. Yeah.
He probably thought about it and actually added up individual names, whereas I just guessed a number. So,
There were clues from earlier on in the parliament, you know, where issues where the whips had just completely dropped the ball, failed to understand what was going to happen. I didn't have a number, but I thought it would be quite high just because of the combination of number 10 sounding very complacent about it and every previous occasion when it's been the job of the whips to say, it's okay, it's going to be fine. They've got it completely wrong. So I thought, well, they'll be high then.
Ian, regular listeners will know that for months we were saying that the Sue Gray report should trigger a vote of no confidence, but I didn't think we always believed that it would. And it didn't sort of happen straight away. What do you think happened during that period? Like, why now? Because there were some people arguing it's just gone on too long, there's no smoking gun in the Gray report, etc., etc. And yet, the thing that we were hoping would happen did happen. Not the second thing we were hoping would happen, but the first thing.
Their chills were multiplying.
you must stop.
I'm losing control. I can't hear.
Maybe they just thought there are worse things he could do. Sorry.
Fuck my life. Okay. Can we talk about politics? I never usually want to talk about politics, but let's fucking do that. I don't know. I mean, it's so disparate, and there's clearly no structure to the opposition to him within the party, as you can tell by virtue of the fact that it's coming from the right, that it's coming from the One Nation, from the left of the party. So that makes it very chaotic, and it means all these different events, things like, and yeah, it is things like being booed, you know, at the Platy Jubes.
Correct. That's what the Queen calls it.
Poll, which was very fucking ugly and is the kind of thing that makes people look at their own seat. And probably the arrogance and disdain of his response to the Gray Report. But I think the thing is, just because they're disparate doesn't mean that there isn't group momentum at the same time. Parliament sort of, especially when people are rebels, has this sort of secondary level of cooperation within it. So, you know, when people rebel, they're outside of that sort of, you know, they're going to face the whips, they're going to get threatened, they're going to lose the sort of little dangling baubles they could achieve. And usually they have groups of people in their own party, and sometimes cross-party, but usually within their own party, that give them a bit of resilience, a bit of steel. That's essentially how the Brexiters were operating for years before we actually got to the referendum thing. Those are the guys that you're there in the no lobby, even though you're suddenly stood by a bunch of Labour MPs and you're like, what the fuck am I doing in this room? You know, this is the wrong place to be. And so those little background informal groupings of MPs will have had a sense of momentum and of people talking to each other and saying, well, hang on a minute, this is just going a bit too far now. So I think the reason it's so hard to analyse is because it's both disparate and yet because it is happening, you know, in Parliament with politicians who talk to each other all the time, it also has that sense of internal momentum to groupings which we don't see any of their conversations.
So, because I was going to ask, would it have been wiser to wait until the by-elections in Wakefield and Tiverton and Honiton, where the Tories are likely to get hammered? Are you saying that actually there wasn't, it's not as if anybody was in a position to make a decision of like, and now we strike?
No, exactly. Yeah, exactly. You're basically kind of lost. You don't know when that number is going to get hit, because I don't think of any of those groups on their own probably had the numbers in order to secure that. And that also makes it paradoxically quite weirdly dangerous for him, because if everyone was coming from one side, if it was all the right wingers saying this, he could placate them, as he's doing with, you know, Rwanda and the protocol and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But actually, he kind of doesn't really have any place to go politically, because it seems that there's rebels on each of those sides. I also think there's probably enough rebels, if you were to just take the right-left stuff, so get rid of things like, you know, MPs who are sitting there thinking, well, I haven't even made PPS, so, you know, I'm not getting anywhere in my career, so it's essentially a selfish thing rather than a political thing. Even if you just to take the right and the left of the party, on their own, looking at that number against him, there might be enough to defeat him in a vote, just right on its own, left on its own, and then you really are fucked. You know, so when we start thinking, well, how is it, you know, he's safe for a year, that wouldn't be... Well, actually, he really isn't safe for a year, because the kind of numbers that he's dealing with now are the kind of numbers that will really slice you up very, very badly indeed in Parliament.
Because those rules that we keep hearing about, that you can't have another one for a year, it turns out that the 1920 committee can just change the rules.
And do what it fucking likes, yeah.
Graham Brady loves it, doesn't he?
He enjoys this so much.
He fucking loves it.
Also, you know what's great about him is as soon as he comes on TV, even if you didn't know anything about politics, you'd just be like, Tory MP. It's just written all over, he's like a puppet.
Roz, Johnson reportedly told the 1922 committee, as our video referenced, that he would do it again. What happened to humble sad face Bojo?
He just can't help himself, can he? He just loves it. He sees he got away with it, or he thinks he got away with it. And what he's actually doing when he does this is he's going out and he's saying it and he's watching the audience and he's waiting for them to give their little smile and say, oh, it's just amazing, gets away with it every time. He loves that kind of audacity. And that's his, you know, that's his MO. That's what he does. But, you know, that is why it is so important now that every time that Johnson appears in public, every single time, we boo him. Because for Johnson, it is all about the performance.
Don't boo us!
He's not here!
It is all about the performance. And when the performer is booed, then he will start realising it really is curtains.
It's worse than that. I think he actually thinks he's the victim here. That was what really, the statement that he made when he stood up in the Commons and said, managed to sort of be contrite for all of about, I'd say, half a second. What was very clear almost immediately afterwards was that the fact that he felt he was a victim of the situation because it was so, and which is a very typical of a narcissistic personality, that you think the fact that people are like putting this burden of responsibility, their morality, onto you. You feel it as an imposition of history. I'm not speaking from experience. I'm a very conscientious person. But you see that, and that's why, you know, what he finds it so hard not to exude that sense of grievance, because that ultimately, he thinks he has nothing to answer for.
Roz, I do remember when we thought at certain points, we discussed this, that we thought that Johnson wanted the prestige of becoming PM and of having been PM, but not actually the job of being PM. And has his determination to hang on surprised you? Do you think, is it something to do, is it just power is addictive? Is it vanity? Because he really does not want to go.
No, he doesn't. And it hasn't surprised me too much, because he hasn't got a legacy yet. And he knows that he needs some sort of legacy. And he can't leave Downing Street until he's got that. And this is why, you know, during Johnson's career, we have seen a succession of big projects and ideas that he wants to be associated with his name. Bikes, buses, bridges to France, to Ireland, whatever, you know, wherever is convenient. He is all about the big project. That is because he knows that he will leave no intellectual or policy legacy, that what he does will not change people's lives for the better at all. There is no chance of him doing that, and a part of him knows that. So he has to leave something big behind. And what we see here is his obsession with Pericles coming out again. He's obsessed with the guy. And Pericles, of course, made the Acropolis happen. You know, he needs his Hadrian's Wall. He needs somebody else to
also
build
a bit
something.
Of a dick.
Yeah.
Pericles.
He needs something that somebody else is going to build, but will have his name on it.
Can we just build something really, really quickly, and so that he'll go?
It's tempting, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, how about a really crap bus?
How long does it take to build a bridge?
How about a really crap bus that, you know, is so rubbish that it overheats and you have to close off the back because the plan to keep the back open never worked? I mean, you could start with something really, really rubbish like that.
Maybe just rename the Shard into Johnson Tower. Maybe that will do.
The Johnson. Just call it
the Johnson.
The Johnson. Yeah. One thing I would add to that quickly also is that, and this was not my... I don't know the guy personally, but not my judgment, something that this number 10 said to me, above all, he hates losing. So that he doesn't want to go now because that would be giving his enemies something. And that's why, and that's what the rest of the Conservative Party needs to understand, that he would genuinely rather destroy the Conservative Party than give anyone in the Conservative Party the satisfaction of having got better of him.
Good guy. Raph, his allies can't seem to agree on what he should do now, and some say he should unite the party by asking arch-enemy Jeremy Hunt to be Chancellor, and other people want a sort of round of punishment beatings and withdrawing the whip from the kind of unrepentant rebels, thus reducing his majority to show them all. What do you think? I mean, and he is known to have a vindictive streak.
Yeah, exactly.
What do you think he will do?
Well, that, and not only vindictive, but also... because he is so fundamentally unreliable and sort of self-absorbed and solipsistic, he presumes that everyone else behaves as he does. So he can't trust other people because he's always thinking they're going to betray him. Mm-hmm. And you know, so he sees infidelity and dishonesty as the default setting. So he's not going to be able to reach out to other people and do the broad church thing at all. He can't. And he's not going to make Jeremy Hunt Chancellor of the Exchequer. I mean, I saw that today. It reminds me of that phase in the Brexit negotiations where people were just talking about the most ridiculous, like the Malthouse Compromise, which is, you know, like the Brady Amendment, these things that bore no relationship at all to what you actually needed to do, but that someone had cooked up because in some theoretical realm on some chessboard in some Telegraph, you know, editorial writer's head, this would solve the problem. It's not going to happen. And I mean, what he can do is, I mean, also I think going back to what Roz was saying, yes, he's a performer. He loves being loved and he loves applause, but he's also a bully. And when a bully loses the audience, they double down with that bit of the audience that's still cheering for them and seek a victim. And they have to victimize someone else to get the cheers. Mm-hmm. You know, so that noise that you're going to get of cheering around Boris Johnson is the noise of the people in the playground who are laughing at the bully as he doubles down harder on the person who he's making cry.
This is what's going to happen in part two if this goes wrong.
All right, but so I think it will get very nasty.
So the absence of any obvious replacement has obviously helped him, and not so long ago it was like Truss, Sunak as the leading figures. Is there anybody else, like a Penny Mordaunt or a Tom Tugendhat, whoever, that there's some kind of momentum behind, or is it basically that same situation where they just don't know who to replace him with?
Well, I mean, there is quite a strong tradition in British politics of not the obvious person getting it. You know, on the Labour side, David Miliband didn't become leader of the Labour Party. Ken Clark never became leader of the Conservative Party. Michael Heseltine never became leader of the Conservative Party. You know, no one predicted in 2016 that Boris Johnson's first leadership campaign would completely fall apart because, you know, Michael Gove stabbed him and, you know, and somehow Theresa May comes through. So it's not that obvious. I'd keep an eye on Ben Wallace, for example. I think he's the sort of slightly John Major-y figure, people who kind of go, who's that guy actually? John Major was Chancellor of the Exchequer, you know, before he became Prime Minister, but no one had even noticed the guy somehow. And so this Defence Secretary, I ticks a lot of boxes. That's where, if I was a gambling man, that might be where I'd put some money. And if you put money on that and it wins and it comes up, can I have some of it, please? Because I'm actually not a gambling man, but you know, I'll happily take someone else's winnings.
Alex, the Rebels are, as Ian said, very diverse from all kind of parts of the party. Do you think, I mean, he has a tradition of never pacifying the moderates. I mean, the phrase Tory left is a hard one to say. But, you know, moderates, he never seems to want to give them anything and always seems to want to give the right something. Do you see that's the way it's going? I love the way that their brilliant idea is just tax cuts. But essentially, if you just had, like, a kind of, I don't know, like a parrot that you taught to be a Conservative, yeah. And just every time I just go, tax cuts, tax cuts. It's like, it's not some bold new vision here, is it?
I think the interesting thing is he will try to pacify everyone and fail, because what actually everyone wants from him is the only thing he can't give them, because they want someone who looks like they have a plan, who looks like they're in control. Even if they disagree with a plan, they want someone who looks like they have a plan. But being in control and having a plan takes hard work. And that's the one element he's not willing to put into it. So it's interesting. I mean, I feel exhausted from the last couple of years. And I often think, what must it be to be in that party? I mean, they must be fucking exhausted from just waking up in the morning and picking up the newspaper and going, oh, Christ, what now? And I think that is because there's a part of the Johnson story that has fooled them, and I think fooled me for the longest time. And I know very few people who are not taken in by this. And that's the notion that the clown is a carefully constructed persona, but behind that is a genius that's kind of three steps ahead. Mm. And then if you think, wait, who's putting that narrative out? Well, it's journalist colleagues and members of his family. So maybe he arrived at this place where if he slips on a banana skin, everyone will assume that he did it for a reason.
He was just trying to sit down.
But maybe he's just a guy that falls over a lot. And he's invented this story that when things go wrong, because I'm chaotic and so things go wrong all the time, it's because I mean it. It's because really I'm a genius and I'm somehow manipulating the audience in that way. And I think people are beginning to realize, certainly I began to realize a few months ago, that that's not the case. He's actually not very bright, and he's incredibly lazy. And those are two things that you need for this job. So he can't do the job. That's the bottom line.
Well, it's funny because I remember, you know, another one of those conversations that was going around was how Trumpian is he? Mm. And when you say not very bright, quite lazy, people have all these theories about how there's a real sort of cunning plan behind it, but there isn't.
That's quite Trumpian. I mean,
like I say, he's becoming more
at its basic level. Well, I think he was that before Trump, to be honest. I don't know. When Trump wrote The Art of the Deal, which was ghostwritten by someone else and is a terrible business book, like it's how to make your business go bust.
It worked.
And so maybe, I don't know, maybe they grew up in parallel. But I just find it interesting that my perception of Johnson has changed, because I always assumed if he's fucked up, you know, if he's hanging by a zip wire, it must be for a reason, because he's getting the press attention. Maybe he's just rubbish.
I'd slightly disagree about the intelligence. I think, and there were all kinds of different types of intelligence.
You know, sure.
Paul Gascoigne had a certain type of intelligence with his feet, just not with his head and his mouth. But with Johnson, you know, people who've studied with him and have worked with him, they do say he does have quite a prodigious capacity to like take in information very quickly and understand things. And he's not an actual idiot, but what he is extremely skilled at is that very specific thing that the British public school and then Oxford education really grooms you for, which is just cherry picking a handful of things, making an argument, being articulate, you know, with the available data to say anything and bluffing it, basically. And that is a quality that, combined with the accent and all the accoutrements of the establishment and being a bit of a toff in manner, we as a country we have learned and we've been groomed to believe is intelligence. It's a very specific skill. It's much more theatrical than actually intellectual or rational. And the interesting thing about the Trump comparison is, you know, I've thought about this a lot, and you know, because they are very different in many ways, and Trump, you know, it's a very different style, but what Trump is to the American idiom, which is coming up through the celebrity model and the sort of stadium-filling bombast, which is a very American form of impressing people, is, you know, their equivalent of what for us is that Oxbridge bluffing thing. It's actually, they are, in their own idiomatic ways, they are very, very similar, but just stylistically, because culturally we like the British understanding
version of it. I agree he's intelligent. I don't think he's smart. And I don't think those two things are the same.
Well, I suppose you need a kind of,
you know, smart is a kind of intelligence that involves a little bit of wisdom and a little bit of streetwisery.
He's not wise.
And he doesn't. He doesn't. You know, it's a classic definition that, you know, someone intelligent knows how to get out of a tight spot, but someone smart doesn't get into it. And I think that's the
that's wise.
The essence of it.
That's a wise thing you said.
You know, I didn't say it. No, someone said it, and I'm going to go for Mencken.
Pericles.
I mean, Pericles. It's usually Mencken.
Roz, Alex said that many Tories were exhausted. Someone who's not exhausted is Nadine Dorries, who's got a lot of energy, literally swivel-eyed. She came out hard against Jeremy Hunt, accusing him of underfunding the NHS when he was health secretary. Is the sort of hope, is Labour's hope that basically that there's going to be enough bitterness, the Tories are going to write all their attack lines for them, so by the time, except Ben Wallace, no one's having a go at Ben Wallace. So if it's been anybody else, you know, they're already going to have had like the attack written by other Tories.
Yeah, I mean, undoubtedly. They hope that it's a circular firing squad situation. I think ultimately the Tory party has been in the grip, and to a certain extent the wider country, has been in the grip of a personality cult. And it's really hard to admit that that's the case. It's really hard to admit that you've fallen for that. Mm. And the party has not admitted itself to its, as we saw from the vote. It's not ready to face that truth. And until it does, we're stuck with him. But when it does, it will all come tumbling down very, very fast.
I'm looking forward to that week on the podcast. Finally, Raf, the general view is that a wounded Johnson stumbling on is great news for Labour. You're a bit sceptical.
I am a bit. I have a kind of a rational reason for being wary of that scenario and an irrational one. The rational one is that I just think, you know, a lot of the presumptions about how he goes are based on the idea that he's, you know, at some stage the normal mechanisms operate and there's some pressure of dignity or honour, these things operate. And actually, if he just really, really doesn't want to, if he wants to go full Trump insurrection, actually, constitutionally, there isn't that much to stop him. And he's still got, you know, the Mail, when it comes down to it, the Telegraph, the Express, others behind him. If it gets close enough to an election, you could, vote leave machine,
right,
that can just organise the most ferocious culture war on his behalf and just put everything that we've just had behind us and pretend it never happened and go, no, if you make Keir Starmer the Prime Minister, then literally there'll be a plague of frogs and we'll all be, you know, drinking effluent for breakfast and it'll be awful. Yeah, that will just crank up. And I don't think Starmer's a great campaigner, and I'm just not entirely confident that that couldn't get some purchase if he gets through the next few months. So I just want him out, to be safe. And then that brings me to the sort of less rational thing, which is just almost superstitious fear that he can survive almost anything. It's like that scene in the horror film where, like, yes, you've emptied the gun into the monster and you've thrown the empty gun at the monster and you think it's dead, but you know there's a jump scare coming where it goes, and it's back, you know, comes out the, and that just
Carrie's hand coming out from the ground.
Exactly. You know, until the stake is through his heart and there is someone else in Downing Street, I won't believe that he's beaten. And that's the top two signs of it. Do you see what I mean?
Ian, there was actually one thing I wanted to ask about. Presumably there will be a reshuffle. We've talked a lot about how the Tory party at the moment is not overburdened with talent. And so I'm wondering, is there anybody who isn't being deployed in the cabinet who Johnson would feasibly put in the cabinet?
Yeah, I mean, Lee Anderson is one of the most venal, stupid human beings I've ever looked at. So I presume he'll be there soon. Did you actually want political analysis?
I'm wondering what...
Because that literally was it. I did.
That was a good answer. Is there anybody that sort of that... Well, I was going to say of cabinet caliber, but you look at the cabinet...
No, but that's the crucial thing, right? The caliber of cabinet for him is you are so weak you don't have any capacity for independent thought or scrutiny or challenge. Okay, so on that basis, you really do start looking... And that's not that new. There was always a... You know, even under May, under Cameron, and even under Brown and Blair, there was always this tendency that if someone was there who actually knew quite a lot about something, if they're like, I've just spent sort of 8 years with this sort of environmental charity, that was usually a detriment to you ending up doing anything to do with the environment. Because, like, oh, fuck, well, you might actually think for yourself. So we can't have you anywhere near it. We have to make sure it's someone who doesn't know shit. There's a moment with Caroline Noakes, who's actually very, very impressive, and in the Parliamentary Conservative Party, which is not two things that ever usually go together, but are true in her case. And she had that kind of experience, loads of stuff with the countryside, with animal welfare, and then, you know, it comes up and they're like, would you like to do immigration? And she was like, if you look in Hansard, I've never used the word immigration in the House of Commons in my life. And they were like, no, exactly. That's why we want you in there, you know, because you don't know. Because you could just be moved around.
It's like a sort of improv troupe approach to government, isn't it? It's just like, no, we're just going to throw a brief at you, see what you do with it.
Exactly. That is our entire constitutional system. You just described it in one sentence.
Yes, yeah. And?
And? Rwanda?
Go home, Vans!
Could we yet see Nadine Dorries as Foreign Secretary leading the war against Ukraine?
All of these things can happen. She probably doesn't have... You know, there's partly a bit that we all think that she's just a raving lunatic, and she is. And I get it. And if you watch especially the interview this week, there are bits in that interview where you can almost see her eyes darting down at her mouth, just being like, what the fuck is it doing now? Like, and so that is totally a thing that happens. Because she was giving a lot of shit away during that interview.
And the donors have spoken. That was a great... The donors have spoken. I just said the bit in my head out loud.
And then she also did literally say, we're going to have economic growth because the Bank of England have decided it.
Yeah.
And you were like, oh, that's good. So I'm glad like you've worked out how that works now.
I like the idea of replacing the peoples with the donors. We're going to deliver on the donors' priorities and deliver a donors' Brexit. Yeah. Just like
the will
mask
of the donors.
Off.
Yeah.
It's refreshing authenticity, I think you'll find.
Yeah, that's donorist government.
But she does have maybe a secondary function and probably a conscious one as, you know, the person that pushes the message a little bit further, right? So, you know, when she comes out on Channel 4 or on BBC, she spreads all this stuff. You have a little test there, you fly a little kite, you see what the response is to that, then you maybe don't go quite as far on the legislation as she was suggesting, so it doesn't seem as bad as it was. And I suspect that she is absolutely 100% a fucking imbecile, but also she is deployed as a very specific kind of imbecile to kind of, you know, further the government's agenda and to test out ideas.
In that sense, she's the incarnation of something that Boris Johnson does rhetorically. He does this thing that where he'll say, Well, obviously, I'm not going to say that Keir Starmer is a paedophile. That would be an extraordinary thing to say. All I am going to say is that when this thing happened, and so he's done it. He's made the allegation in a way that denies the allegation. And Nadine Dorries is literally the incarnation and personification of that. She'll say the crazy stuff that you know he once said, but he's like, well, for God, well, I wouldn't put it exactly as Nadine had said it, but, and it's very clever.
And this is to nobody in particular, but hopefully one of you will answer. No, the idea that some people were saying that someone like Jeremy Hunt, who is relatively sort of moderate, would be a real problem for Keir Starmer, because then it would be two kind of fairly boring, sensible people that you don't really want to hear talk. But then at the same time, the Tory leaders are elected by the Tory membership, who are a wild bunch. And so I'm wondering, is there anybody that you could see that would be genuinely threatening to, that would so occupy the centre ground that the Tory membership would choose, but would so occupy that it would actually sort of shut down a lot of space for Starmer? Is that like a feasible? Because there are a couple of sensible Tories that I could imagine, yeah, but I can't imagine them actually becoming leader.
As soon as you said the Jeremy Hunt versus Keir Starmer thing, it's because they both look, they often both look quite startled. So you can imagine that PMQs would just be like two guys going, whoa, be like quite a jangly, nervy experience.
They also both have supply teacher voice. You know, yeah, that voice that sort of it's slightly pleading for authority, yeah, as opposed to having authority.
Come on, yeah, come on, guys, come on. We've got a lot to get through today. Yeah, no, funny. I enjoy a laugh too, but got a lot of policies to get through.
There's a chance that someone like Penny Mordaunt could fulfil that function. I mean, and also, of course, the Tories are very keen on women leaders. They appeal to a certain part of the Tory psyche that I don't fully pretend to understand.
Or want to.
But, you know, that's why they went for Theresa May as well. Mm. It's an instinct to go for the woman to sort things out when things are bad. That is quite deep-rooted, I think, in the party. But the problem, it will be, is that this country is in such a load of trouble that any Tory leader is going to struggle in the next yeah, 6 months, in the next year, in the next 18 months. We are in deep, deep trouble. And I'd be amazed if any leader, and certainly not anybody anywhere near the current government, could turn that around.
I mean, I think the only manoeuvre that could work is someone that comes in with just enough time to instill some party discipline, but not enough time to actually do anything, so they can make the argument, I'm doing it, just give me a bit more time. That would be quite dangerous, and I think Penny Mordaunt is actually. I think after this period of chaos, I think anyone that's a bit of an army brat actually has a decent chance, Mordaunt, Tugendhat, Wallace, because they can authentically say that I'm going to run a tighter ship. And I think that's going to be very attractive.
A country is always in a good state when you want to bring in someone from the army.
Send for the generals. Yeah,
right. They'll sort things out. Before the break, we're going to do a quick quiz. And making our way through the greatest hits of the Johnson years. Astonishingly, we found some. Anybody can kind of can venture an answer here. At the Tory party conference in 2019, Johnson waved a fish at the audience to criticise EU fishing regulations. Well, what was special about the kipper?
It wasn't at the Tory conference. It was at the debate, the final debate with Hunt.
To be fair, I think he did it at both.
Maybe.
I think he went down so well at
Tory
conference.
Yeah, he does the
conference.
Same shtick.
He did it again.
Are you changing the quiz, master?
No, sorry. He's around with a fish in his pocket.
I'm so sorry. No, yeah.
Roz, you're fishing is your
yes.
specialism.
You've got to remember.
What was special about the kipper? Oh, I don't know. I mean, apart from being a kipper, and then it has kind of subliminal undertones with, you know, I'm appealing to UKIP because it's a kipper, like Nigel Farage. No, I can't remember because it was. Was it frozen? Was that it?
No.
Was it because it was frozen, and now kippers need no longer be frozen?
No. It was, he claimed that the EU had made a law that meant every kipper had to travel with a little ice pack. But But actually,
well, I knew it was something.
But
to do
actually, nice. A, that was UK legislation. The EU has no such rule for smoked fish. And secondly, which I think is even funnier, the kipper was from the Isle of Man. Yeah. It was handed to him by an Isle of Man producer who are not in the EU. So their status when they want to sell into the EU hasn't changed one bit.
Very good. So you get bonus points. Boris and Carrie Johnson's Downing Street flat refurbishment included handcrafted gold leaf wallpaper. How much did it cost per roll?
Oh, shit.
£850.
I want the answer in guineas now, actually.
Not sovereigns. Surely sovereigns are the currency.
Shillings per yard.
That's actually 650 sovs.
It's 840. That is an amazing memory.
But now it's 850. It was 840 then.
Got an eye on it for my own
that's
living
true.
Room.
That's
true.
That's ridiculous.
I know. Do you remember the whole thing about the expensive wallpaper?
No, yeah, but I didn't remember it was that expensive. Yeah.
Well, it's gold. Gold's expensive.
Alex, you're like, I used to think he was all right, but I've gone off him now.
Gold wallpaper, taxpayers.
But 840 quid. My first flat didn't cost that.
Finally, Boris Johnson promised that a post-Brexit trade deal with Australia would bring the wonder of Tim Tams to our shores. But what is a Tim Tam?
Oh, is it like a wagon wheel?
No.
It's like a wagon wheel, but crossed with malt loaf.
No, it's not a wagon wheel.
It's a penguin, it's like a bit softer. Oh, yeah.
It's got marshmallow, what? Isn't it?
No,
it's
marshmallow.
It's like a penguin, isn't it?
It is, I'm told. It consists of two malted biscuits separated by a light, hard chocolate cream filling and coated in a thin layer of textured chocolate. The creators went to Britain, found the Penguin Bar, and said, with what I find repellent Aussie arrogance, they wanted to make a better one.
It is better, to be fair.
Oh, fair dues then. Okay.
Because the middle is kind of less dense. Oh. And so what they do is they bite like a corner off the top and off the bottom. And you use it as a straw to suck milky tea through. And then if you do it for just the right amount of time, you shove it in your mouth and it kind of falls apart.
That's it. I'm voting leave. I've changed my mind. I want one of those. So,
it's so good.
That sounds amazing.
It is an amazing experience. But if you get it wrong, it literally just goes into poop in your hand.
Like Brexit.
Like Brexit.
If after this, we don't have a fucking advertising contract with those bastards, with you reading this shit out halfway
it's
through
not,
the show.
It's genuinely like, not. That was like, you have to get it from a well-known online retailer. And it's like a tenner a packet.
Oh
it's
God.
Ridiculously expensive.
Well,
I don't know why.
Well, worth every penny.
Big Penguin, I think, is keeping it out.
So that's Alex 2, Roz 1. Ian and Raph, it's a hero. But
I mean, that was fair on the basis that we didn't actually answer any questions. Yeah. So
there's everything to play for. In part two. Yeah.
In just a minute, you'd give us bonus points for like having for getting a laugh out of the audience.
Oh, but it's not. No. And that's the first half. Have a drink. We'll see you soon.
Hello, it's Andrew, the producer here. That was part one of Oh God, What Now? Live in Brighton. We'll be releasing part two over the weekend so you can find out who won the Boris Johnson quiz and also if Britain needs a vibe shift for its political future. But if you want to hear the whole thing right now and you just can't wait, you can hear it without adverts, unedited, via Patreon. Just sign up to support us on Patreon for as little as £2 a month and you'll get that, plus all of our podcasts without adverts and loads of nice stuff too. Hope you enjoyed this one. Hold tight for the next bit.